After Scott had gone, Ruth found the head of his racket in the laundry room. She threw it in the trash, together with what was left of the racket handle. Then she started a load of laundry, just her squash gear and some underwear, and the towels that she and Scott had used. She mainly wanted to hear the washing machine. The sound of it running was reassuring to her. The empty house was too quiet. Next, she drank nearly a quart of water and, naked again, carried a clean towel and two ice packs out to the pool. She took a long, hot shower in the outdoor stall, soaping herself twice and washing her hair twice, too. And then she sat on the bottom step in the shallow end. She put one ice pack on her right shoulder and held the other ice pack against her face, covering her cheekbone and her right eye. Ruth had avoided looking in a mirror, but she could tell that her cheekbone and her eye were swollen. Her right eye wouldn't open wider than a slit. In the morning, the eye would be completely closed. After the hot shower, the pool felt cold at first, but the water was truly silky smooth and much warmer than the night air. It was a clear night. There must have been a million stars. Ruth hoped it would be as clear the next night when she had to fly to Europe. But she was too tired to think more about her trip than that. She let the ice numb her. She was sitting so still that a small frog swam right up to her. She cupped it in her hand. She reached out and let the frog go on the deck where it hopped away. Eventually, the chlorine would have killed it. Then Ruth rubbed her hand under the water until the sensation of the frog's slipperiness was gone. The slime had reminded her of her two recent experiences with a lubricating jelly. When she heard the washing machine stop, she got out of the pool and transferred her wet laundry to the dryer. She went to bed in her own room and lay in her clean sheets, listening to the comfortingly familiar tap or click of something spinning around and around in the dryer. But later, when she had to get out of bed to go to the bathroom, it hurt her to pee, and she thought about the unfamiliar place far inside her, where Scott Saunders had poked her. It also hurt there. The latter pain was not sharp, it was an ache, like the onset of her cramps. Only it wasn't time for her cramps. And it wasn't a place where she'd ever felt pain before. In the morning, she called Alan before he left for the office. "Would you love me any less if I gave up squash?" Ruth asked him. "I don't think I've got many more games in me. That is, not after I beat my father."
"Of course I wouldn't love you any less," Alan told her.
"You're too good for me," she warned him.
"I told you I loved you," he said.
God, he really must love me, Ruth thought. But all she said was, "I'll call you again from the airport."
Ruth had examined the fingerprint bruises on her breasts. There were fingerprint and thumbprint bruises on her hips and buttocks, too, but Ruth couldn't see all of them because she could see only out of her left eye. She still refused to look at her face in a mirror. She knew without looking that she should continue to put ice on her right eye, which she did. Her right shoulder was stiff and sore, but she was tired of icing her shoulder. Besides, she had things to do. She'd just finished packing when her father came home.
"My God, Ruthie, who hit you?"
"It's just a squash injury," she lied.
"Who are you playing?" her father asked.
"Mostly myself," she told him.
"Ruthie, Ruthie," her father said.
He looked tired. He didn't look 77, but Ruth decided that he looked like someone in his 60s. She loved the smooth backs of his small, square hands. Ruth found herself staring at the backs of his hands because she couldn't look him in the eye, not with her swollen, shut right eye anyway.
"Ruthie, I'm sorry," her father began.
"About Hannah. I don't want to hear about it, Daddy," Ruth told him. "You can't keep your pecker in your pants, as they say. It's the same old story."
"But Hannah, Ruthie," her father tried to say.
"I don't even want to hear her name,"
Ruth told him. Okay, Ruthie. She couldn't stand to see how sheepish he was. She already knew he loved her more than he loved anyone else. Worse, Ruth knew that she loved him, too. She loved him more than she loved Alan, and certainly more than she loved Hannah. There was nobody Ruth Cole loved or hated as much as she loved and hated her father. But all she said to him was, "Get your racket." "Can you see out of that eye?" her father asked her. "I can see out of the other one," Ruth told him. Ruth gives her father a driving lesson. It still hurt her to pee, but Ruth tried not to think about it. She quickly got into her squash clothes. She wanted to be in the court, warming up the ball before her father was ready to play. She also wanted to erase the blue smudge of chalk that marked the dead spot on the front wall. Ruth didn't need the chalk mark to know where the dead spot was. The ball was already warm and very lively when Ruth felt that almost imperceptible shudder in the floor. Her father was climbing up the ladder in the barn. She sprinted once to the front wall, then turned and sprinted to the back, all before she heard her father tap his racket twice and open the squash court door. Ruth felt only a twinge of pain in that unfamiliar place where Scott Saunders had poked her the wrong way. If she didn't have to run too hard, she would be okay. That she couldn't see out of her right eye was a bigger problem. There were going to be moments when she wouldn't be able to see where her father was. Ted didn't crash around the court. He moved as little as he had to. But when he moved, he glided. If you couldn't see him, you didn't know where he was. Ruth knew it was crucial to win the first game. Ted was toughest in the middle of a match. If I'm lucky, Ruth thought, it will take him a game to locate the dead spot. When they were still warming up, she caught her father squinting at the front wall of the court, looking for that missing smudge of blue. She took the first game 18-16. But by then her father had pinpointed the dead spot, and Ruth was picking the ball up late on his hard serve, especially when she received his serve in the left-hand court. With no vision in her right eye, she practically had to turn and face him when he served. Ruth lost the next two games, 12-15 and 16-18, but although he was leading 2-1 in games, it was her father who needed the water bottle after their third game. Ruth won the fourth game, 15-9. Her father hit the tin in losing the last point. It was the first time that either of them had hit the tin. They were tied 2-2 in games. She'd been tied with her father before. She'd always lost. Many times, just before the fifth game, her father would tell her, "I think you're going to beat me, Ruthie." Then he would beat her. This time, he didn't say anything. Ruth drank a little water and took a long look at him with her one good eye. "I think I'm going to beat you, Daddy," she told him. She won the fifth game, 15-4. Once again, her father hit the tin in losing the last point. The telltale sound of the tin would ring in her ears for the next 4 or 5 years. "Good job, Ruthie," Ted said. He had to leave the court to get the water bottle. Ruth had to be fast. She was able to pat him on the ass with her racket as he was going out the door. What she wanted to do was give him a hug, but he wouldn't even look her in her one good eye. "What an odd man he is," she thought. Then she remembered the oddness of Eddie O'Hare trying to flush his change down the toilet. Maybe all men were odd. She'd always thought it strange that her father found it so natural to be naked in front of her. From the moment that her breasts began to develop, and they had developed most noticeably, Ruth had not felt comfortable being naked in front of him. Yet showering together in the outdoor shower and swimming naked together in the pool, well, weren't these activities merely family rituals? In the warm weather, anyway, they seemed to be the expected rituals, inseparable from playing squash. But upon his defeat, her father looked old and tired.
Ruth couldn't bear the thought of seeing him naked, nor did she want him to see the fingerprint bruises on her breasts and the thumbprint and fingerprint bruises on her hips and buttocks. Her father might have believed that her black eye was a squash injury, but he knew more than enough about sex to know that she couldn't have got her other bruises playing squash. She thought she would spare him those other bruises. Of course, he didn't know he was being spared. When Ruth told him that she felt like a hot bath instead of a shower and a swim, her father felt he'd been rebuffed. "Ruthie, how are we ever going to put the Hannah episode behind us if we don't talk about it?"
"We'll talk about Hannah later, Daddy. Maybe after I'm back from Europe."
For 20 years, she'd been trying to beat her father at squash. Now that she'd finally defeated him, Ruth found herself weeping in a bathtub. She wished she could feel even the slightest elation at her moment of victory. Instead, Ruth wept because her father had reduced her best friend to an episode. Or was it Hannah who'd reduced their friendship to something less than a fling with her father? "Oh, don't pick it apart. Just get over it," Ruth told herself. So they had both betrayed her. So what?
When she got out of her bath, she made herself look in the mirror. Her right eye was a horror, a great way to begin a book tour. The eye was puffy and closed, the cheekbones swollen, but the discoloration of the skin was the most striking aspect of her injury. For an area roughly the size of a fist, her skin was a dark reddish purple, like a sunset before a storm, the vivid colors tinged with black. It was such a lurid bruise. It was half comical. She would wear the bruise for the duration of her 10-day tour in Germany. The swelling would go down, and the bruise would finally fade to a sallow yellow color, but the injury might still be discernible on her face the following week in Amsterdam, too. She intentionally hadn't packed her squash clothes, not even her shoes. She'd purposely left her rackets in the barn. It was a good time to give up squash. Her German and Dutch publishers had arranged matches for her. They would have to cancel them. She had an obvious, even a visible, excuse. She could tell them her cheekbone was broken and that she'd been advised by a doctor to let it heal. Scott Saunders might very well have broken her cheekbone. Her black eye didn't look like a squash injury. If she'd been hit that hard by her opponent's racket, she would have had a cut and stitches, in addition to the bruise. The story should be that she was struck by her opponent's elbow. In order for that to happen, Ruth would have had to have been standing too close to her opponent, crowding him from behind. In such a circumstance, Ruth's imaginary opponent would have to have been a left-hander in order to hit her in her right eye. To tell a believable story, the novelist knew, you just have to get the details right. She could imagine it being funny in the interviews that lay ahead of her. "Traditionally, I've had a hard time with left-handers." Or, "There's always something with left-handers that you don't see coming." For example, they fuck you from behind after you tell them you don't like it that way, and they slug you when you tell them it's time to leave. Or, they fuck your best friend. Ruth felt familiar enough with left-handed behavior to make up a pretty good story. They were in heavy traffic on the Southern Parkway, not far from the turnoff to the airport, when Ruth decided that she'd not defeated her father to her satisfaction. For 15 years or more, whenever they drove anywhere together, Ruth usually drove, but not today. Back in Sagaponack, as he was putting her 3 bags in the trunk, her father had said to her, "Better let me drive, Ruthie. I can see out of both eyes." Ruth hadn't argued. If her father drove, she could say anything to him, and he wouldn't be permitted to look at her, not while he was driving. Ruth had begun by telling him how much she'd liked Eddie O'Hare. She'd gone on to say that her mother had already thought of leaving before the boys were killed. It had not been Eddie who'd given Marion the idea.
and Ruth told her father that she knew he had planned her mother's affair with Eddie. He had set them up, knowing how vulnerable Marion might be to a boy who reminded her of Thomas and Timothy. And of course it had been an even easier assumption on her father's part that Eddie would fall hopelessly in love with Marion. "Ruthie, Ruthie," her father started to say, "keep your eyes on the road and in the rear-view mirror," she told him. "If you even think about looking at me, you better pull over and let me drive."
"Your mother was terminally depressed, and she knew it," her father told her. "She knew she would have a terrible effect on you. It's an awful thing for a child to have a parent who's always depressed."
Talking to Eddie had meant so much to Ruth. But everything Eddie had told her meant nothing to her father. Ted had a fixed idea of who Marion was and why she'd left him. Indeed, Ruth's meeting with Eddie had failed to make any impression on her father. That was probably the reason that the desire to devastate her father had never been as strong in Ruth as it was when she began to tell him about Scott Saunders. Clever novelist that she was, Ruth first led her father into the story by misleading him. She began with meeting Scott on the jitney and their subsequent squash match.
"So that's who gave you the black eye," her father said. "I'm not surprised. He charges all over the court, and he takes too big a backswing. He's a typical tennis player."
Ruth just told the story, step by step. When she got to the part about showing Scott the Polaroids in her father's bottommost drawer, Ruth began to speak of herself in the third person. Her father hadn't known that Ruth knew about those photographs, not to mention his night table drawer, which was full of condoms and the lubricating jelly. When Ruth got to the part about her first sexual experience with Scott, and how she'd hoped, when Scott had been licking her, that her father would come home and see them through the open door of the master bedroom, her father took his eyes off the road, if only for a half second, and looked at her. "You better pull over and let me drive, Daddy," Ruth told him. "One eye on the road is better than no eyes." He watched the road and the rear-view mirror while she went ahead with her story. The shrimp hadn't tasted much like shrimp, and she hadn't wanted to have sex a second time. Her first big mistake was to straddle Scott for so long. "Ruth fucked his brains out," was how she put it. When she got to the part about the phone ringing and Scott Saunders entering her from behind, even though she'd told him that she didn't like it that way, her father took his eyes off the road again. Ruth got angry with him. "Look, Daddy, if you can't concentrate on the driving, you're not fit to drive. Get off the road. I'll take over." "Ruthie, Ruthie," was all he managed to say. He was crying. "If you're upset and you can't see the road, that's another reason to pull over, Daddy." She described her head banging against the headboard of the bed, how she'd had no other choice but to push her hips back against him, and later how he'd hit her not with a squash racket. Ruth thought it was a straight left. She never saw it coming. She'd just curled up and hoped that he wouldn't keep hitting her. Then, when her head had cleared, she'd gone downstairs and found Scott's squash racket. Her first shot took out his right knee. It was a low backhand, she explained, naturally with the racket face sideways. "You took his knee out first?" her father interrupted her. "Knee, face, both elbows, both collarbones, in that order," Ruth told him. "He couldn't walk?" her father asked. "He couldn't crawl," Ruth said. "He could walk with a limp." "Jesus, Ruthie, did you see the sign for Kennedy?" she asked him.
"Yes, I saw it," he said. "You didn't look like you saw it," Ruth told him.
Then she told him how it still hurt her to pee, and that there was a pain in an unfamiliar place inside her. "I'm sure it will go away," she added, dropping the third person. "I've just got to remember to stay out of that position."
"I'll kill the bastard," her father told her.
"Why bother?" Ruth asked. "You can still play squash with him when he's able to run around again. He's not very good, but you can get a halfway decent workout with him. He's not bad exercise."
"He virtually raped you. He hit you," her father shouted.
"But nothing's changed," Ruth insisted. "Hannah's still my best friend.
You're still my father.
Okay, okay, I get it, her father told her. He tried to wipe the tears off his face with the sleeve of his old flannel shirt. Ruth loved this particular shirt because her father had worn it when she'd been a little girl. Still, she was tempted to tell him to keep both his hands on the wheel. Instead, she reminded him of what airline she was taking and the terminal he should be looking for.
You can see, can't you? She asked. It's Delta.
I can see. I can see. I know it's Delta, he told her. And I get your point. I get it. I get it.
I don't think you'll ever get it, Ruth said. Don't look at me. We're not stopped yet. She had to tell him.
Ruthie, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Do you see where it says departures? She asked him.
Yes, I see it, he said.
It was the way he'd said, good job, Ruthie, after she'd beaten him in his goddamn barn. When her father finally stopped the car, Ruth said, good driving, Daddy. If she'd known then that it would be their last conversation, she might have tried to patch things up with him. But she could see that, for once, she'd truly defeated him. Her father was too badly beaten to be uplifted by a simple turn in their conversation. And besides, the pain in that unfamiliar place inside her was still bothering her. In retrospect, it would have to suffice that Ruth remembered to kiss her father goodbye. In the Delta Crown room, before she boarded the plane, Ruth called Alan. He sounded worried on the phone, or as if he was being less than candid with her. It gave her a pang to imagine what he might think of her if he ever knew about Scott Saunders. Alan would never know about Scott. Hannah had got Alan's message. She'd returned his call, but he'd been brief with her. He'd told Hannah that there was nothing wrong, that he'd spoken to Ruth, and that Ruth was fine. Hannah had suggested that they meet for lunch or for a drink just to talk about Ruth, but Alan had told Hannah that he was looking forward to meeting her with Ruth when Ruth was back from Europe. I never talk about Ruth, he told her. It was the closest Ruth had come to telling Alan that she loved him. But she could still hear something worried in his voice, and it troubled her. As her editor, he'd withheld nothing.
What's wrong, Alan? Ruth asked.
Well, he began, sounding like her father. Nothing, really. It can wait.
Tell me, Ruth said.
There was something in your fan mail, Alan told her. Normally no one reads it. We just forward it to Vermont, but this was a letter addressed to me, to your editor, that is. And so I read it. It's really a letter to you.
Is it hate mail? Ruth asked.
I get my share of it. Is that all it is? I suppose that's all it is, Alan said. But it's upsetting. I think you ought to see it.
I will see it when I get back, Ruth told him.
Maybe I could fax it to your hotel, Alan suggested.
Is it threatening? Is it a stalker? She asked. The word stalker always gave her a chill.
No, it's a widow. An angry widow, Alan told her.
Oh, that, Ruth said. She'd expected that. When she wrote about abortion, not having had an abortion, she got angry letters from people who had had abortions.
When she wrote about childbirth, not having had a child, or when she wrote about divorce, not having been divorced or married, well, there were always those letters. People denying that imagination was real, or insisting that imagination wasn't as real as personal experience. It was the same old thing.
For God's sake, Alan, Ruth said, you're not worried about another reader telling me to write about what I know, are you?
This one is a little different, Alan replied.
All right, fax it to me, she told him.
I don't want to worry you, he said.
Then don't fax it to me, Ruth said.
Then she added, because the thought suddenly occurred to her, is this a stalking widow or just an angry one? Look, I'll fax it to you, he told her. Is this something you should show to the FBI? Is it like that? Ruth asked him.
No, not really. I don't think so, he said.
Just fax it, she told him.
It'll be there when you arrive, Alan promised her. Bon voyage!
Why was it that women were absolutely the worst readers when it came to something that touched upon their personal lives, Ruth thought? What made a woman presume that her rape, her miscarriage, her marriage, her divorce, her loss of a child or a husband was the only universal experience that there was? Or was it merely the case that most of Ruth's readers were women, and that women who wrote to novelists and told them their personal disaster stories were the most fucked-up women of all?
Ruth sat in the Delta Crown room, holding a glass of ice water against her black eye. It must have been her faraway expression, in addition to her obvious injury, that prompted a fellow traveler, a drunken woman, to speak to her. The woman, who was about Ruth's age, had a hardened expression on her pale, drawn face. She was too thin, a chain smoker with a raspy voice and a southern accent thickened by booze.
"Whoever he was, sweetie, you're better off without him," the woman told Ruth.
"It was a squash injury," Ruth replied.
"He hit you with a squash?" the woman slurred. "Shit, it must have been a hard one."
"It was pretty hard," Ruth admitted, smiling. On the plane, Ruth quickly drank two beers. When she had to pee, she was relieved that it hurt a little less. There were only three other passengers in first class and no one in the seat beside her. She told the flight attendant not to serve her any dinner, but she asked to be awakened for breakfast. Ruth reclined in her seat. She covered herself with a thin blanket and tried to make her head comfortable on the small pillow. She would have to sleep on her back or on her left side. The right side of her face was too sore to sleep on. Her last thought, before she fell asleep, was that Hannah had been right again. "I am too hard on my father. After all, as the stupid song goes, he's just a man." Then Ruth was asleep. She would sleep all the way to Germany, trying in vain not to dream.
A widow for the rest of her life. It was Alan's fault. Ruth would never have dreamt all night about her other hate mail or her occasional stalkers if Alan hadn't told her about the angry widow. There'd been a time when she'd answered all her fan mail. There was so much of it, after her first novel especially, but she'd made the effort. Oh, she'd never bothered with the bitchy letters. If the tone of any letter was even partially pissy, Ruth threw it away without answering it. "For the most part, your incomplete sentences notwithstanding, I was mildly enjoying your book, but the repeated inconsistencies with serial commas and your misuse of the word hopefully eventually wore down my tolerance. I stopped on page 385, where the most egregious example of your groceryist style stopped me and sent me looking for better prose than yours."
Who would bother to answer a letter like that? But the objections to Ruth's writing were more often complaints about the content of her novels. "What I detest in your books is that you sensationalize everything. In particular, you exaggerate the unseemly." As for the so-called unseemly, Ruth knew that it was of sufficient offense to some of her readers that she even contemplated it, not to mention that she exaggerated it. Nor was Ruth Cole entirely sure that she did exaggerate the unseemly. Her worst fear was that the unseemly had become so commonplace that one couldn't exaggerate it. What got Ruth in trouble was that she used to answer her good mail, but it was the good mail that you had to be most careful about not answering. Particularly dangerous were those letters in which the letter writer claimed not only to have loved a book by Ruth Cole, but that the book had changed his or her life. There was a pattern. The letter writer always professed an undying love for one or more of Ruth's books. Usually there was some personal identification with one or more of Ruth's characters, too. Ruth would write, thanking the person for his or her letter. The second time the person wrote to Ruth, the letter writer was much more needy. Often the second letter was accompanied by a manuscript.
I loved your book. I know you're going to love mine. That kind of thing. Commonly, the letter writer would suggest a meeting. The third letter would express how hurt the letter writer felt because Ruth hadn't responded to the second letter. Whether Ruth responded to the third letter or not, the fourth letter would be the angry one or the first of many angry ones. That was the pattern. In a way, Ruth thought, her former fans, those fans who were disappointed that they couldn't get to know her personally, were more frightening than the creeps who hated her from the beginning. The writing of a novel demanded privacy. It called for a virtually isolated existence. In contrast, the publication of a book was an alarmingly public experience. Ruth had never been any good at the public part of the process.
"Guten Morgen," the flight attendant whispered in her ear. "Frühstück."
Ruth was wrecked by her dreams, but she was hungry and the coffee smelled good. Across the aisle, a gentleman was shaving. He sat leaning over his breakfast, peering into a small handheld mirror. The sound of his electric razor droned like an insect against a screen. Below the breakfast eaters lay Bavaria, growing greener as the clouds lifted. The fog was burned away by the first rays of the morning sun. It had rained overnight. The tarmac would still be wet when the plane landed in Munich. Ruth liked Germany and her German publishers. It was her third trip. As always, everything on her itinerary had been explained to her beforehand, and her interviewers would actually have read her book. At the registration desk in her hotel, they were expecting her early arrival. Her room was ready. The publisher had sent flowers and photocopies of her early reviews, which were good. Ruth's German was not good, but she could at least understand her reviews. At Exeter and at Middlebury, it had been her only foreign language. The Germans seemed to like her for trying to speak their language, even though she spoke it badly. It was a phonetic language, which Ruth liked. Practicality appealed to her. This first day, she would force herself to stay awake until noon. Then she would take a nap. 2 or 3 hours was about right for the jet lag. Her first reading was that evening. It was out in Freising. Later that weekend, after her interviews, she would be driven from Munich to Stuttgart. Everything was clear. Clearer than it ever is at home, Ruth was thinking, when the woman at the reception desk said, "Oh, and there's a fax for you." The hate mail from the angry widow. For a moment, Ruth had forgotten all about it. "Willkommen in Deutschland," the woman at the desk called to her as Ruth turned and followed the bellman to the elevator. "Welcome to Germany." "My dear," the widow's letter began, "this time you have gone too far. It may be true, as I have read in one of your reviews, that you have a satirical gift for choreographing an unusual number of society's ills and human foibles in one book, or for gathering the innumerable moral calamities of our time into the life of a single character. But not everything in our lives is comic material. There are certain tragedies that resist a humorous interpretation. You have gone too far." "I was married for 55 years, the widow continued. Her late husband was a mortician, Ruth decided. "When my husband died, my life stopped. He meant the world to me. When I lost him, I lost everything. And what about your own mother? Do you imagine that she found a way to put a comic spin on the death of your brothers? Do you think you were abandoned by a woman who left you and your father to pursue a life in satire?" "How dare she," thought Ruth Cole. "You write about abortion and childbirth and adoption, but you've never even been pregnant. You write about being a divorcee and a widow, but you've never even been married. You write about when it's safe for a widow to re-enter the world, but there is no such thing as a widow for 1 year. I will be a widow for the rest of my life." Horace Walpole once wrote, "The world is a comedy to those that think, and a tragedy to those who feel. But the real world is tragic to those who think and feel. It is only comic to those who've been lucky." Ruth flipped to the end of the letter, and then back to the beginning. but there was no return address. The angry widow hadn't even signed her name. Her letter ended as follows: "All I have left is prayer. I will include you in my prayers." What does it say about you that at your age you have never been married, not even once? I will pray for you that you get married. Maybe you will have a child, maybe not. My husband and I loved each other so much that we never wanted children. Children might have spoiled it. More important, I will pray that you will truly love your husband and that you will lose him. What I will pray for you is that you become a widow for the rest of your life. Then you will know how untruthfully you have written about the real world. In lieu of a signature, the woman had written, "A widow for the rest of her life." And there was a P.S., which gave Ruth the shivers. "I have a lot of time for prayers." Ruth would fax Alan in New York and ask him if the angry widow's name or address had appeared on the envelope, or, failing that, from what city or town had the letter been mailed. But the answer would be as disturbing as the letter. The letter had been hand-delivered to the Random House building on East 50th Street. The receptionist could not remember the woman, or if it even was a woman, who'd brought the letter to the editorial floor. If the praying widow had been married for 55 years, she had to be in her 70s, if not in her 80s or her 90s. Maybe the angry old woman did have a lot of time for prayers, but she didn't have a lot of time left to live. Ruth slept for most of the afternoon. The ranting widow's letter was not that upsetting. And maybe it was fair. If a book was any good, it was a slap in the face to someone. An angry old woman's letter is not going to ruin my trip, Ruth decided. She would walk, she would send postcards, she would write in her diary. Except for Frankfurt and the book fair, where it was impossible to relax, Ruth was determined to restore herself in Germany. Her diary entries and her postcards suggest that to some degree she did, even in Frankfurt. Ruth's diary and selected postcards. Not a bad reading in Freising, but either I or the audience was duller than I expected. Dinner afterwards in a former monastery with vaulted ceilings. I drank too much. Each time I'm in Germany, I'm reminded of the contrast. In a place like the lobby of the Vier Jahreszeiten, between the expensively dressed hotel guests, the business class, who are so formal, and the deliberately disreputable appearance of the journalists, who appear to revel in their grubbiness like teenagers intent on offending their parents. A society in ugly confrontation with itself, so much like ours, but at the same time in advance of ours and even more deteriorated. Either I'm not over the jet lag, or a new novel is beginning in the back of my mind. I absolutely cannot read anything without skipping ahead. The room service menu, the list of the hotel's amenities, Norman Sherry's The Life of Graham Greene, Volume 1, which I did not intend to bring with me. I must have put it in my carry-on without thinking. All I can read are the last lines of paragraphs that seem important, those final sentences before space breaks on the page. Only occasionally will there be a sentence in the heart of a paragraph that stands out, and I'm incapable of reading anything consecutively. My mind keeps jumping ahead. Sherry writes of Green, "His seeking out of the seedy, the sordid, the sexual and the deviant took him in many directions, as his diary shows." I wonder if my diary shows it, too. I hope so. It galls me that seeking out the seedy, the sordid, the sexual, and the deviant is the expected, if not altogether acceptable, behavior of male writers. It would surely benefit me as a writer if I had the courage to seek out more of the seedy, the sordid, the sexual, and the deviant myself. But women who seek out such things are made to feel ashamed, or else they sound stridently ridiculous in defending themselves as if they're bragging. Suppose I paid a prostitute
to let me watch her with a customer, to absorb every detail of the most furtive encounters. Isn't this, in a way, what a writer should do? Yet there are subjects that remain off-limits for women writers. It's not unlike the dichotomy which exists regarding one's sexual past. It is permissible, even attractive, for a man to have had one, but if a woman has had a sexual past, she'd better keep quiet about it. I must be beginning a new novel. My distraction is too focused for jet lag. I'm thinking about a woman writer, someone more extreme than I am, more extreme as a writer and as a woman. She makes every effort to observe everything, to absorb every detail. She doesn't necessarily want to be single, but she believes that marriage will impose restraints on her. It's not that she needs to experience everything. She's not a sexual adventurer. But she does want to see everything. Suppose she pays a prostitute to let her watch her with a customer. Suppose she doesn't dare do that alone. Let's say she does it with a boyfriend. A bad boyfriend, of course. And what transpires with the boyfriend as a result of observing the prostitute is so degrading, so shameful, that it's enough to make the woman writer change her life. Something happens that's more than seedy, something too sordid, too deviant. This novel is a demonstration of one kind of sexual inequality. The woman writer, in her need to observe, goes too far. As for exactly what happens, the specific experience with the prostitute? If the writer were a man, there would be no guilt, no degradation. Norman Sherry, Green's biographer, writes of the novelist's right and need to use his own and others' experience. Mr. Sherry thinks there is a ruthlessness to this right of the novelist, to this terrible need. But the relationship between observation and imagination is more complicated than mere ruthlessness. One must imagine a good story. Then one must make the details seem real. It helps to make the details seem real if some of the details are real. Personal experience is overrated, but observation is essential. It's definitely not jet lag, it's a novel. It begins with paying a prostitute, an act traditionally contaminated with shame. No, stupid, it begins with the bad boyfriend. No doubt I'll make him left-handed. A strawberry blonde boyfriend. I'm so sick of Hannah telling me that I should shut off my biological clock and get married, or not, for the right reasons, not merely because my body thinks it wants to have a baby. Hannah may have been born without a biological clock, but she certainly responds to all the other things her body thinks it wants, if not a baby. In a postcard to Hannah, which was a display of sausages in Munich's Viktualienmarkt, "I forgive you. But you forgive yourself a little too easily. You always have. Love, Ruth." The drive from Munich to Stuttgart. The pronunciation of Schwäbische Alb. The farmland with red and blue and green cabbages. In Stuttgart, the hotel is on the Schillerstrasse, a modern hotel with lots of glass. The pronunciation of Schlossgarten. The questions from the young people in the audience after my reading are all about the social problems in the United States. Because they see my books as critical of American society, they invite me to express my perceived anti-Americanism. The interviewers extend the same invitation. And now, given their pending reunification, the Germans also want to know what I think of them. What do Americans in general think of Germans? Are we happy about German reunification? I would rather talk about storytelling, I tell them. They wouldn't. All I can say is that my lack of interest in what interests them is genuine. They don't like my answer. In the new novel, the prostitute should be an older woman, someone not too intimidating to the woman writer.
Her bad boyfriend wants a younger, better-looking prostitute than the one the woman writer eventually chooses. The reader should anticipate the boyfriend's awfulness, but the woman writer doesn't see it coming. She's concentrating on her observations of the prostitute, not just on the prostitute's customer, or least of all on the mechanically familiar act, but on all the surrounding details of the prostitute's room. There should be something concerning what the woman writer likes and dislikes about men. Possibly she asks the prostitute how she is able to overcome her physical abhorrence of certain types of men. Are there men the prostitute says no to? There must be. Prostitutes can't be totally indifferent to, well, the details of men. It should happen in Amsterdam. A, because prostitutes are so available there. B, because I'm going there. C, because my Dutch publisher is a nice guy. I can persuade him to see and talk to a prostitute with me. No, stupid. You should see the prostitute alone. What I like, Alan's aggressiveness most of the time. I like the limits of his aggressiveness, too. And his criticism, at least of my writing. I can be myself with him. He tolerates me. He forgives me. Maybe too much. I feel safe with him. I would do more, read more, go out more with him. He wouldn't force himself on me. He hasn't forced himself on me. He would be a good father. What I don't like, he interrupts me, but he interrupts everybody. It's not that his eating habits, I mean his table manners, embarrass me. It's more that I find the way he eats repellent. There is the fear that I would find him sexually repellent, too. And there's the matter of the hair on the backs of his hands. Oh, get over it. In a postcard to Alan, which was of an 1885 Daimler in the Mercedes-Benz Museum in Stuttgart. Do you need a new car? I'd like to take a long drive with you. Love, Ruth. On the flight from Stuttgart to Hamburg, then in a car from Hamburg to Kiel, there are a lot of cows. We are in the state of Schleswig-Holstein, where the cows of that name come from. My driver is a sales rep for my publisher. I always learn something from sales reps. This one explains that my German readers expect me, personally, to be more political than I am. The sales rep tells me that my novels are political in the sense that all social commentary is political. The sales rep says, "Your books are political, but you aren't." I'm not sure if this is offered as criticism or simply stated as a fact, but I believe it. And the subject comes up in the questions from the audience after the reading in the Kunsthalle in Kiel, a good crowd. Instead, I try to talk about storytelling. I'm like someone who makes furniture, I tell them. So let's talk about a few things that have to do with chairs or tables. I can see by their faces that they want this to be more complicated, more symbolic than it is. I am thinking of a new novel, I explain. It's about that point in a woman's life when she decides she wants to be married. Not because there's a man in her life whom she truly wants to marry, but because she's sick and tired of bad boyfriends. The laughter is sporadic and discouraging. I try it in German. There's more laughter, but I suspect the laughter is because of my German. It could be my first book with a first-person narrator, I tell them. Now I see that they have lost all interest in English and in German. Then it would be called My Last Bad Boyfriend. The title is terrible in German. It is greeted with more dismay than laughter. Mein letzter schlimmer Freund. It sounds like a novel about an adolescent disease. I pause for a drink of water and see the audience slipping away, especially from the seats in the rear of the hall. And those who have stayed are painfully waiting for me to finish. I don't have the heart to tell them that the woman I'm going to write about is a writer. That would really kill their interest. So much for the craft of storytelling or the concrete concerns of the storyteller. Even I am bored with trying to entertain people on the subject of what it is I really do. From my hotel room in Kiel, I can see the ferries on the North Sea. They are en route to and from Sweden and Denmark. Maybe one day I could go there with Alan. Maybe one day I could travel with a husband and a child, and with a nanny for the child. The woman writer I'm thinking about, does she truly believe that marriage will be the death of her freedom to observe the world? If she were already married, she could have gone with her husband to see and talk to a prostitute. For a woman writer, having a husband could give her more freedom of observation. Maybe the woman I'm writing about doesn't know that. I wonder if Alan would object to observing a prostitute with her customer with me. Of course he wouldn't. But the person I should really ask to do this with me is my father. In a postcard to her father, which was of the prostitutes in their windows on the Herberstrasse, the red-light district in the St. Pauli quarter of Hamburg. Thinking of you, Daddy. I'm sorry about what I said. It was mean. I love you, Ruthie. The flight from Hamburg to Köln, the drive from Köln to Bonn, the grandeur of the university. For the first time, someone in the audience asked about my eye. In my interviews, all the journalists have asked. This was a young woman. She looked like a student, and her English was almost perfect. "Who hit you?" she asked. "My father," I told her. The audience was suddenly hushed. With his elbow, we were playing squash. "Your father is young enough to play squash with you?" the young woman asked. "No, he is not young enough," I told her, "but he's in pretty good shape for a man his age." "I suppose you beat him, then," the student said. "Yes, I beat him," I answered. But after the reading, the same young woman handed me a note. "I don't believe you. Someone hit you," the note said. This I also like about the Germans. They come to their own conclusions. Of course, if I write a first-person novel about a woman writer, I am inviting every book reviewer to apply the autobiographical label, to conclude that I am writing about myself. But one must never not write a certain kind of novel out of fear of what the reaction to it will be. And I can just hear Alan on the subject of my writing two novels in a row about women writers. Yet I've heard him say that editorial advice should not include recommendations or caveats about what to write or to not write about. Doubtless I shall have to remind him of that. But more important to this new novel, what does the bad boyfriend do as a result of observing a prostitute with her customer that is so degrading to the woman novelist? What happens to make her feel so ashamed that it's enough to make her change her life? After watching the prostitute with her customer, the boyfriend could be so aroused that the way he makes love to the woman writer makes her feel that he is thinking about someone else. But that's just another version of bad sex. It must be something more awful, more humiliating than that. In a way, I like this phase of a novel better than the actual writing of it. In the beginning, there are so many possibilities. With each detail you choose, with every word you commit yourself to, your options close down. The matter of searching for my mother or not. The hope that one day she will come looking for me. What are the remaining major events in my life? I mean, the events that might make my mother come to me. My father's death? My wedding, if I have one? The birth of my child, if I have one? If I ever get up the nerve to have children, I would want only one. Maybe I should announce my forthcoming marriage to Eddie O'Hare. That might get my mother's attention. I wonder if Eddie would go along with it. After all, he wants to see her, too. In a postcard to Eddie O'Hare, which was of the great Cologne Cathedral, the splendid Dom, the largest Gothic cathedral in Germany. "Being with you, talking with you,
It was the most important evening in my life so far. I hope I see you again soon. Sincerely, Ruth Cole.
In a postcard to Alan, which was of a magnificent castle on the Rhine, "Be an editor. Choose between these two titles, Her Last Bad Boyfriend or My Last Bad Boyfriend. In either case, I like the idea. Love, Ruth. P.S. Buy me this house and I'll marry you. I think I might marry you anyway." On the train from Bonn to Frankfurt, another title for the new novel occurs to me. Maybe it is more appealing than My Last Bad Boyfriend, but only because it would permit me to write another book in the third person. What She Saw, What She Didn't Know. I suppose it's too long and too literal. It would be even more exact with a semicolon. What she saw, what she didn't know. I can imagine Alan's opinion of a semicolon in a title. He takes a dim view of my semicolons anyway. "No one knows what they are anymore," he says. "If you're not in the habit of reading 19th-century novels, you think that the author has killed a fruit fly directly above a comma. Semicolons have become nothing but a distraction." Yet, I think I want to marry him. It's a 2-hour trip from Bonn to Frankfurt. My Frankfurt itinerary is my longest and busiest. Only 2 readings, but back-to-back interviews. And at the book fair itself, there is a panel discussion, which I am dreading. The topic is German reunification. I'm a novelist, I will doubtless say at some point. I'm just a storyteller. Looking over the list of my fellow panelists, other authors, all promoting their books at the book fair, there is an atrocious American male of the unbearable intellectual species. And there is another American writer, female, less well-known but no less atrocious. She is of the pornography violates my civil rights school. If she hasn't already reviewed Not for Children, she will. And not kindly. There is also a young German novelist whose work has been banned in Canada. There was some charge of obscenity, in all probability not entirely unmerited. It's hard to forget the specific obscenity charge. A character in the young German's novel is having sex with chickens. He's caught in a posh hotel with a chicken. A terrible squawking led the hotel staff to make the discovery that, and the hotel maid had complained of feathers. But the German novelist is interesting in comparison to the other panelists. I'm a comic novelist, I will doubtless say at some point. I always do. Half the audience, and more than half of my fellow panelists, will take this to mean that I am not a serious novelist. But comedy is ingrained. A writer doesn't choose to be comic. You can choose a plot or not to have one. You can choose your characters, but comedy is not a choice. It just comes out that way. Another panelist is an English woman who's written a book about so-called recovered memory, in her case, hers. She woke up one morning and remembered that her father had raped her, and her brothers had raped her, and all her uncles. Her grandfather, too. Every morning she wakes up and remembers someone else who raped her. She must be exhausted. Regardless of how heated the debate on the panel is, the young German novelist will have a faraway expression on his face, as if something serenely romantic has just crossed his mind. Probably a chicken. I'm just a storyteller, I will say again and again. I'm not good at generalizations. Only the chicken lover understands me. He gives me a kindly look, maybe mildly desirous. His eyes tell me you might look a lot better with some reddish-brown feathers. As the train is pulling into the Frankfurt Hauptbahnhof, I first notice my cough. In Frankfurt, in my small room at the Hessischer Hof, drinking a beer that isn't very cold. At midnight, it becomes October 3rd. Germany is reunited. On the TV, I watched the celebrations in Bonn and Berlin. A moment of history, alone in a hotel room. What can one say about German reunification? It's already happened. Coughed all night. Called the publisher this morning, then the publicist. It's such a shame to cancel my appearance on the panel, but I must save my voice for my readings. The publisher sent me more flowers. The publicist brought me a package of cough drops with organically grown Swiss Alpine herbs. Now I can cough through my interviews with my breath smelling of lemon balm and wild thyme. I've never been happier to have a cough. On the elevator, there was the tragicomic Englishwoman. From the look of her, she doubtless awakened with the recovered memory of yet another rape. At lunch in the Hessischer Hof, there was, at another table, the German novelist who does it with chickens. He was being interviewed by a woman who interviewed me earlier this morning. My interviewer at lunch was a man with a bigger cough than mine. And when I was alone, just sipping coffee at my table, the young German novelist looked at me whenever I coughed, as if I had a feather caught in my throat. I truly love my cough. I can take a long bath and think about my new novel. In the elevator, like a small man inflated to grotesque size with helium, there is the atrocious American male, the unbearable intellectual. He seems offended when I step into the elevator with him. "You missed the panel. They said you were sick," he tells me. "Yes." "Everyone gets sick here. It's a terrible place." "Yes." "I hope I don't catch something from you," he says.
"I hope not."
"I'm probably already sick. I've been here long enough," he adds. Like his writing, it's unclear what he means. Does he mean he's been in Frankfurt long enough to catch something, or does he mean he's been in the elevator long enough to have been exposed to what I've got? "Are you still not married?" he asks me. It's not a pass, it's a signature non sequitur of the kind the unbearable intellectual is renowned for. "Still not married, but maybe about to be," I answer.
"Ah, good for you," he tells me.
I'm surprised by his genuine fondness for my answer. "Here's my floor," he says. "Sorry you weren't on the panel."
"Yes."
Ah, the little heralded chance encounter between world-famous authors. Is there anything that compares to it? The woman writer should meet the strawberry blonde boyfriend at the Frankfurt Book Fair. The bad boyfriend is a fellow fiction writer, very minimalist. He's published only 2 books of short stories, fragile tales, so spare that most of the story is left out. His sales are small, but he has been compensated by the kind of unqualified critical adoration that often accompanies obscurity. The woman novelist should be a writer of big novels. They are a parody of the proverbial wisdom that opposites attract. In this case, they can't stand each other's writing. Their attraction is strictly sexual. He should be younger than she is. They begin an affair in Frankfurt, and he comes with her to Holland, where she is going, after the book fair, to promote a Dutch translation. He doesn't have a Dutch publisher, and he has been far less in the limelight in Frankfurt than she has been. Although she hasn't noticed this, he has. He hasn't been in Amsterdam since he was a student, a summer abroad. He remembers the prostitutes. He wants to take her to see the prostitutes, maybe a live sex show, too. "I don't think I want to see a live sex show," the woman novelist says. It could be his idea to pay a prostitute to let them watch. "We could have our own live sex show," the short story writer says. He seems almost indifferent to the idea. He implies that she might be more interested in it than he is. "As a writer," he says, "for research." And when they're in Amsterdam, and he's escorting her through the red light district, he keeps up a casual, light-hearted banter. "I wouldn't want to see her do it.
She looks inclined to bondage, that kind of thing. The minimalist makes her think that watching a prostitute will be merely a naughty bit of hilarity. He gives her the impression that the most difficult part of it will be trying to contain their laughter, because, of course, they can't reveal their concealed presence to the customer. But I wonder how the prostitute would hide them so that they could see without being seen. That will be my research. I can ask my Dutch publisher to walk with me through the red light district. After all, it's a thing tourists do. He probably is asked by all his women authors. We all want to be escorted through the seedy, the sordid, the sexual, and the deviant. The last time I was in Amsterdam, a journalist walked with me through the red light district. It was his idea. So I will get a look at the women. I remember that they don't like it when women look at them. But I'm sure I'll find one or two who don't absolutely terrify me, someone I can go back to alone. It will have to be someone who speaks English, or at least a little German. One prostitute might be enough, as long as she was comfortable about talking to me. I can imagine the act without seeing it, surely. Besides, it is what happens to the woman in hiding, the woman writer, that most concerns me. Let's presume the bad boyfriend is aroused, even that he masturbates while they're hiding together, and she can't protest or even make the slightest move to get away from him without the prostitute's customer knowing that he's being watched. Then how can he masturbate? That's a problem. Maybe the irony is that the prostitute has at least been paid for how she's used, but the woman writer is used too. She has spent her money to be used. Well, writers must have thick skins. No irony there. Alan called. I coughed for him. Now that there is no immediate possibility for us to have sex, given the ocean between us, naturally, I felt like having sex with him. Women are perverse. I didn't tell him about the new book, not a word. It would have spoiled the postcards. In another postcard to Alan, which was an aerial view of the International Book Fair, boasting some 5,500 publishers from some 100 countries. Never again without you. Love, Ruth. On the KLM flight from Frankfurt to Amsterdam, both my cough and my black eye are barely with me. The cough exists only as a tickle at the back of my throat. The eye and my right cheekbone remain vaguely discolored, chartreuse, a yellowish green. There's no swelling, but the color suggests that I have been sick for a long time and that the sickness, like my cough, is lingering. It's the right look for someone who's about to approach a prostitute. I appear to have an old disease to share. My guidebook for Amsterdam informs me that the red light district known as De Valities, the Little Walls, was officially sanctioned in the 14th century. There are tittering references to the district's scantily clad girls in their shop windows. Why is it that most writing about the seedy, the sordid, the sexual, and the deviant is always so unconvincingly superior in tone? Amusement is as strong an expression of superiority as indifference is. I think that any expression of amusement or indifference toward the unseemly is usually false. People are either attracted to the unseemly or disapproving of it, or both. Yet we try to sound superior to the unseemly by pretending to be amused by it or indifferent to it. Everyone has a sexual hang-up, at least one, Hannah once said to me. But if Hannah has one, she never told me what it is. There are the usual obligations ahead of me in Amsterdam, but I have enough free time for what I need to do. Amsterdam isn't Frankfurt. Nothing is as bad as Frankfurt. And to be honest, I can't wait to meet my prostitute. There is the thrill of something like shame about this research, but of course I am the customer. I'm prepared, indeed I'm fully expecting, to pay her.
In another postcard to Alan, which she mailed from Schiphol Airport, and which, not unlike the earlier postcard she mailed to her father of the German prostitutes in their windows on the Herberstrasse, was of De Valetis, the red light district of Amsterdam. The neon from the bars and sex shops reflecting in the canal, the passers-by, all men in raincoats, the window in the foreground of the photograph framed in lights of a purplish red, with a woman in her underwear in the window looking like a misplaced mannequin, like something on loan from a lingerie shop, like someone rented for a private party. Forget earlier question. The title is My Last Bad Boyfriend. My first-person narrator. Yes, she's another woman writer, but trust me. Love, Ruth. The First Meeting. The publication of Niet voor Kinderen, the Dutch translation of Not for Children, was the principal reason for Ruth Cole's third visit to Amsterdam, but Ruth now thought of the research for her prostitute story as the all-consuming justification for her being there. She'd not yet found the moment to speak of her new excitement to her Dutch publisher, Martin Schouten, whom she affectionately referred to as Martin with two A's and an E. For the translation of The Same Orphanage, in Dutch, Hetzelfde Weeshuis, which Ruth had struggled in vain to pronounce, she had stayed in a charming but run-down hotel on the Prinsengracht, where she'd discovered a sizable stash of marijuana in the small bedside drawer she'd selected for her bras. The pot probably belonged to a previous guest, but such was Ruth's nervousness on her first European book tour that she was certain the marijuana had been planted in her room by some mischievous journalist intent on embarrassing her. The aforementioned Martin with two A's and an E had assured her that possession of marijuana in Amsterdam was barely a noticeable offense, much less an embarrassment. And Ruth had loved the city from the beginning, the canals, the bridges, all the bicycles, the cafes, and the restaurants. On her second visit, for the Dutch translation of Before the Fall of Saigon, she was pleased that she could at least say Voor de Val van Saigon. Ruth stayed in another part of town, on the Dam Square, where her hotel's proximity to the red light district had led one interviewer to take it upon himself to show Ruth the prostitutes in their windows. She'd not forgotten the blatancy of the women in their underwear at midday or the SM specials in the window of a sex shop. Ruth had spotted a rubber vagina suspended from the ceiling of the shop by a red garter belt. The vagina resembled a dangling omelet, except for the tuft of fake pubic hair. And there were the whips, the cowbell, attached by a leather strap to a dildo, the enema bulbs in a variety of sizes, the rubber fist. But that was 5 years ago. Ruth had not yet had the opportunity to see whether the district had changed. She was now staying in her third hotel on the Kattengat. It was not very stylish, and it suffered from a number of graceless efforts to be orderly. For example, there was a breakfast room that was strictly for the guests on Ruth's floor. The coffee was cold, the orange juice was warm, and the croissants lay in a litter of crumbs, suitable only for taking to the nearest canal and feeding to the ducks. On its ground floor and in the basement, the hotel had spawned a health club. The music favored for the aerobics classes could be detected in the bathroom pipes for several floors above the exercise facility. The plumbing throbbed to the ceaseless percussion. In Ruth's estimation, the Dutch, at least while exercising, preferred an unrelenting and unvarying kind of rock music, which Ruth would have categorized as an unrhymed form of rap. A tuneless beat repeated and repeated itself while a European male, for whom English was very much a foreign language, reiterated a single sentence. In one such song, the sentence was, I want to have sex with you. In another, I want to fuck you. Her first-hand inspection of the gym had quickly dashed any tentative interest she might have had in it. A singles bar in the guise of an exercise facility was not for her. She also disliked the self-consciousness of the exercise, the stationary bikes, the treadmills, the stair-climbing devices. They were all in a row, facing the floor for the aerobics classes. No matter where you were, you could not escape seeing the leaping and the gyrations of the aerobic dancers in a plethora of surrounding mirrors. The best you could hope for, Ruth thought, would be to witness a sprained ankle or a heart attack. Ruth decided she would walk instead. The area around her hotel was new to her. She was actually closer to the red light district than she realized, but she began walking in the opposite direction. She crossed the first canal she came to and turned onto a small, attractive side street, the Corsi Sporsteg, where, to her surprise, she encountered several prostitutes. In what seemed to be a well-kept residential area were a half-dozen windows with working women in their lingerie. They were white women, prosperous-looking, if not in every case pretty. Most of them were younger than Ruth, possibly two of them were her age. Ruth was so visibly shocked that she stumbled. One of the prostitutes had a laugh. It was late morning, and Ruth was the only woman walking on the short street. Three men, each of them alone, were silently window-shopping. Ruth had not imagined that she could find a prostitute who might talk to her in a less seedy, less conspicuous place than in the red light district. Her discovery encouraged her. When she found herself on the Bergstraat, once again she was unprepared. There were more prostitutes there. It was a quiet, tidy street. The first four girls, who were young and beautiful, paid no attention to her. Ruth was aware of a slowly passing car, the driver intently looking over the prostitutes. But this time, Ruth wasn't the only woman on the street. Ahead of her was a woman dressed much as Ruth was, black jeans, black suede shoes with a stacked, medium-high heel. The woman, also like Ruth, wore a short, mannish leather jacket, but in dark brown and with a silk paisley scarf. Ruth was walking so quickly that she nearly overtook the woman who, on her arm, carried a canvas shopping bag from which a large bottle of mineral water and a loaf of bread protruded. The woman looked casually over her shoulder at Ruth. She gazed mildly into Ruth's eyes. The woman wore no makeup, not even lipstick, and was in her late 40s. As she passed them by, she waved or smiled to each of the prostitutes in their windows. But near the end of the Bergstraat, at a ground-floor window where the curtains were drawn, the woman abruptly stopped to unlock a door. She instinctively looked behind her before stepping inside, as if she was accustomed to being followed. And again she gazed at Ruth, this time with a more searching curiosity, and with what struck Ruth as something wantonly flirtatious in her at first ironic and then seductive smile. The woman was a prostitute. She was just now going to work. Ruth once more walked past the prostitutes and the Corsi Sporsteg. She was aware of more men on the street, none of whom would look at her or at each other. She recognized two of them. They had made the same circle she had made. How many times would they return for a longer look? This, too, Ruth wanted to know. It was a necessary part of her research. While it would be easier for her, alone, to interview a prostitute on a pleasant, unthreatening street such as this one, or on the Bergstraat, Ruth believed that the character in her novel, that other woman writer with her bad boyfriend, had best suffer her encounter in one of the worst of the rooms in the red light district. After all, if the awful experience was to degrade her and humiliate her, wouldn't it be more appropriate, not to mention more atmospheric, if it happened in the sleaziest environment imaginable? This time, the prostitutes and the Corsi Sporsteg regarded Ruth with wary stares and a barely detectable nod or two. The woman who'd laughed at Ruth when she'd stumbled gave her a cool, unfriendly appraisal. Only one of the women made a gesture that could have been construed as either beckoning or scolding. She was a woman of Ruth's age, but much heavier. Her blonde hair was dyed. The woman pointed an index finger at Ruth and lowered her eyes in exaggerated disapproval. It was a schoolmarmish gesture, although there was no small amount of wickedness in the heavy woman's smirking smile. She might have thought Ruth a lesbian. When she again turned onto the Bergstraat, Ruth walked slowly in the hope that the older prostitute would have had time to dress herself, or to undress herself, as the case might be, and to position herself in her window. One of the younger, more beautiful prostitutes winked openly at Ruth, who felt strangely exhilarated by such a mockingly salacious proposition. The pretty girl's wink was so distracting that Ruth nearly walked by the older prostitute without recognizing her. In truth, the prostitute's transformation was so complete that she was an altogether different woman from the plain person with her shopping bag whom Ruth had seen on the street only minutes ago. In the open doorway stood a vivacious, red-haired whore. Her wine-red lipstick matched her claret-colored bra and panties, which were all she wore except for a gold wristwatch and a pair of jet-black, sling-back, 3-inch heels. The prostitute was now taller than Ruth. The window curtains were open, revealing an old-fashioned bar stool with a polished brass base, but the prostitute wasn't seated there. She was in the midst of a domestic pose. She stood in her doorway with a broom, with which she had just swept from her threshold a single yellow leaf. She held the broom at the ready, offering a challenge to more leaves, and she carefully looked Ruth over from her hair to her shoes, as if Ruth were standing in the Bergstraat in her underwear and high heels, and the prostitute was a conservatively dressed housewife dutifully attending to her chores. That was when Ruth realized that she'd stopped walking, and that the red-haired prostitute had nodded to her with an inviting smile, which, as Ruth had not yet found the courage to speak, was growing quizzical. "Do you speak English?" Ruth blurted. The prostitute seemed more amused than taken aback. "I don't have a problem with English," she said. "I don't have a problem with lesbians either." "I'm not a lesbian," Ruth told her. "That's all right, too," the prostitute replied. "Is it your first time with a woman? I know what to do about that." "I don't want to do anything," Ruth quickly stated. "I just want to talk with you." The prostitute became uncomfortable, as if talk were in a category of aberrant behavior, short of which she drew the line. "You have to pay more for that," the redhead said. "Talk can go on for a long time." Ruth was nonplussed by the attitude that seemingly any sexual activity would be preferable to conversation. "Oh, of course I'll pay you for your time," Ruth told the redhead, who was scrutinizing Ruth meticulously. But it was not Ruth's body that the prostitute was assessing. What interested her was how much money Ruth had paid for her clothes. "It costs 75 guilders for 5 minutes," the redhead said. She had correctly estimated that Ruth wore unimaginative but expensive clothes. Ruth unzipped her purse and peered into her wallet at the unfamiliar bills. Was 75 guilders about $50? It struck Ruth as a lot of money for a 5-minute conversation. For what the prostitute usually provided in the same amount of time, or less, it seemed insufficient compensation. "My name is Ruth," Ruth said nervously. She extended her hand, but the redhead laughed. Instead of shaking hands, she pulled Ruth into her small room by the sleeve of her leather jacket. When they were both inside, the prostitute locked the door and closed the window curtains. Her strong perfume in such a confined area was nearly as overpowering as the redhead's near nakedness. The room itself was all in red. The heavy curtains were a shade of maroon. The rug, a blood-red broadloom, gave off the faded odor of carpet cleaner. The bedspread, which neatly covered a single twin-sized bed, was of an old-fashioned rose-petal pattern. The pillowcase for the solitary pillow was pink. And the towel, which was the size of a bath towel and a different shade of pink from the pillowcase, was folded perfectly in half and covered the center of the bed, no doubt to protect the bedspread. On a chair beside the tidy, serviceable bed stood a stack of these pink towels. They looked clean, if slightly shabby, just like the room. The small red room was ringed with mirrors. There were almost as many mirrors at as many unwelcome angles as there were at the hotel's health club. and the light in the room was so dim that each time Ruth took a step, she saw a shadow of herself either retreating or advancing, or both. The mirrors, of course, also reflected a multitude of prostitutes. The prostitute sat down on her bed in the exact center of the towel, without needing to look where she was sitting. She crossed her ankles, supporting her feet by the spikes of her heels, and leaned forward with her hands on her thighs. It was a pose of long experience which pushed her pert, well-formed breasts forward, exaggerated her cleavage, and allowed Ruth a view of her small, purplish nipples through the claret-colored mesh of her demi-bra. Her bikini panties elongated the narrow V of her crotch and exposed the stretch marks on the prostitute's pouting stomach. She'd clearly had children, or at least one child. The redhead indicated a lumpy, easy chair where Ruth was supposed to sit. The chair was so soft that Ruth's knees touched her breasts when she leaned forward. She needed to cling to the armrests with both hands in order to avoid the appearance of lolling on her back. "The chair works better for blowjobs," the prostitute told her. "My name is Dolores," the redhead added, "but my friends call me Roya." "Roya?" Ruth repeated, trying not to think of the number of blowjobs that had been performed in the cracked leather chair. "It means red," said Roya. "I see," Ruth said, edging herself forward in the blowjob chair. "As it turns out, I'm writing a story," Ruth began, but the prostitute quickly stood up from her bed. "You didn't say you were a journalist," Roya Dolores said. "I don't talk to journalists." "I'm not a journalist," Ruth cried. My, how that accusation stung. "I'm a novelist. I write books, the kind one makes up. I just need to be sure the details are right." "What details?" Roya asked. She wouldn't sit down on the bed. She paced. Her movements allowed the novelist to see some additional aspects of the prostitute's carefully appointed workplace. A small sink was mounted to an interior wall. Beside it was a bidet. There were several more bidets in the mirrors, of course. On a table between the bidet and the bed was a box of tissues and a roll of paper towels. A white enameled tray with an hospital aura held both the familiar and some unfamiliar lubricants and jellies, and a dildo of an uncomfortable size. Like the tray, of a similar hospital or doctor's office whiteness, was a wastebasket with a lid, the kind that was opened by stepping on a foot pedal. Through a partially open door, Ruth saw the darkened WC. The toilet, with a wooden seat, was flushed with a pull chain. And by the standing lamp with the scarlet-stained glass shade, a table next to the blowjob chair held a clean, empty ashtray and a wicker basket full of condoms. These were among the details that Ruth needed, together with the shallowness of the wardrobe closet. The few dresses and nightgowns and a leather halter top could not hang at right angles to the closet's back wall. The clothes were twisted diagonally on their hangers, as if they were prostitutes attempting to show themselves at a more flattering angle. The dresses and the nightgowns, not to mention the leather halter top, were entirely too youthful for a woman of Roya's age. But what did Ruth know about dresses or nightgowns? She rarely wore the former, and she preferred to sleep in a pair of panties and an oversized T-shirt. As for a leather halter top, she'd never considered wearing one of those. Ruth began her story. "Suppose a man and a woman came to you and offered to pay you to allow them to watch you with a customer. Would you do that? Have you ever done that?" "So that's what you want," Roya said. "Why didn't you say so?" "Sure I can do that. Of course I've done that." "Why didn't you bring your boyfriend?" No, I'm not here with a boyfriend," Ruth replied. "I don't want to watch you with a customer. I can imagine that. I just want to know how you arrange it and how common or uncommon it is. I mean, how often are you asked by couples? I would think that men alone would ask you more frequently than couples, and that women alone were... well, rare."
"That's true," Roya answered. "Mostly it's men alone. Some couples maybe once or twice a year.
And women alone?
I can do that if that's what you want, Roya said. I do that from time to time, but not often. Most men don't mind if another woman watches. It's the women who are watching who don't want to be seen.
It was so warm and airless in the room, Ruth longed to take her leather jacket off, but in present company, it would be too brazen of her to be wearing just her black silk T-shirt. Therefore, she unzipped her leather jacket but kept it on. Roya walked over to the wardrobe closet. There was no door. A chintz curtain, in a pattern of fallen autumn leaves, mostly red, hung from a wooden dowel. When Roya closed the curtain, it concealed the contents of the closet, except for the shoes, which she turned around so that their toes were pointed out. There were a half dozen pairs of high-heeled shoes.
You would just stand behind the curtain with the toes of your shoes pointed out, like the other shoes, Roya said.
She stepped through the part in the curtain and concealed herself. When Ruth looked at Roya's feet, she could hardly tell the shoes that Roya was wearing from the other shoes. Ruth needed to be looking for Roya's ankles in order to see them. I see, Ruth said. She wanted to stand in the wardrobe closet to see what her view of the bed would be. Through the narrow part in the curtain, it might be difficult to see the bed. It was as if the prostitute had read her mind. Roya stepped out from behind the curtain.
Here! You try it, the redhead said.
Ruth could not avoid brushing against the prostitute when she slipped through the parted curtain. The entire room was so small that it was next to impossible for two people to move in it without touching. Ruth fitted her feet between two pairs of shoes. Through the narrow slit where the curtain was parted, she had a clear view of the pink towel centered on the prostitute's bed. In an opposing mirror, Ruth could also see the wardrobe closet. She had to look closely to recognize her own shoes among the shoes below the bottom hem of the curtain. Ruth could not see herself through the curtain, not even her own eyes peering through the slit, not even a portion of her face unless she moved. And even then she could detect only some undefined movement. Without moving her head, just her eyes, Ruth could take in the sink and bidet. The dildo in the hospital tray, together with the lubricants and jellies, was clearly visible. But Ruth's view of the blowjob chair was blocked by one armrest and the back of the chair itself.
If the guy wants a blowjob and someone's watching, I can give him a blowjob on the bed, Roya said, if that's what you're thinking.
Ruth hadn't been in the wardrobe closet for more than a minute. She'd not yet noticed that her breathing was irregular, or that her contact with the gold-colored dress on the nearest hanger had made her neck begin to itch. She was aware of a slight discomfort in her throat when she swallowed, the last vestiges of her cough, she thought, or the coming of a cold. When a pearl-gray negligee slipped off a hanger, it was as if her heart had stopped and she had died where she always imagined she would, in a closet.
If you're comfortable in there, Roya said, I'll open the window curtains and sit in the window. But this time of day it might take a while to get a guy to come in, maybe half an hour, maybe as much as 45 minutes. Of course you'll have to pay me another 75 guilders. This has already taken a lot of my time.
Ruth stumbled on the shoes as she rushed out of the wardrobe closet.
No, I don't want to watch, the novelist cried. I'm just writing a story. It's about a couple. The woman is my age. Her boyfriend talks her into it. She's got a bad boyfriend.
Ruth saw, with embarrassment, that she'd kicked one of the prostitute's shoes halfway across the room. Roya retrieved the shoe. Then she knelt at her wardrobe closet, straightening up the other shoes. She returned them all to the usual toes-in position, including the shoe that Ruth had kicked.
"You're a weird one," the prostitute said.
They stood awkwardly beside the wardrobe closet as if they were admiring the newly arranged shoes.
"And your 5 minutes are up,"
Roya added, pointing to her pretty gold watch. Ruth again unzipped her purse. She took 3 25-guilder bills out of her wallet, but Roya was standing close enough to look inside Ruth's billfold for herself. The prostitute deftly picked out a 50-guilder bill.
50 is enough. For 5 more minutes, the redhead said. Save your small bills, she advised Ruth. You might want to come back after you think about it.
So quickly that Ruth didn't anticipate it, Roya pressed closer to Ruth and nuzzled Ruth's neck. Before Ruth could react, the prostitute lightly cupped one of Ruth's breasts as she turned away and again seated herself dead center on the towel protecting her bed.
Nice perfume, but I can hardly smell it, Roya remarked. Nice breasts. Big ones.
Blushing, Ruth tried to lower herself into the blowjob chair without letting the chair claim her.
In my story, the novelist started to say, the trouble with your story is that nothing happens, Roya said. So the couple pays me to watch me do it, so what? It wouldn't be the first time. So what happens then? Isn't that the story?
I'm not sure what happens then. But that is the story, Ruth answered. The woman with the bad boyfriend is humiliated. She feels degraded by the experience, not because of what she sees, but because of the boyfriend. It's the way he makes her feel that humiliates her.
That wouldn't be the first time either, the prostitute told her.
Maybe the man masturbates while he's watching, Ruth suggested. Roya knew it was a question.
It wouldn't be the first time, the prostitute repeated. And why would the woman be surprised at that?
Roya was right. And there was another problem. Ruth didn't know everything that could happen in the story because she didn't know enough about who the characters were and what their relationship was. It wasn't the first time that she'd made such a discovery about a novel she was beginning. It was just the first time that she'd made the discovery in front of another person, not to mention a stranger and a prostitute.
Do you know what usually happens? Roya asked.
No, I don't, Ruth admitted.
The watching is just the beginning, the prostitute told her. With couples especially, the watching just leads to something else.
What do you mean? Ruth asked her.
The next time they come back, they don't want to watch. They want to do something, Roya said.
I don't think my character would come back a second time, Ruth replied. But she considered the possibility.
Sometimes, after the watching, the couple wants to do things immediately. Like right then, Roya said.
What kind of things? Ruth asked.
All kinds, Roya said. Sometimes the guy wants to watch me with the woman. He wants to see me get the woman hot. Usually I start with the guy and the woman watches.
You start with the guy, Ruth said.
Then the woman, Roya said.
That's actually happened? Ruth asked.
Everything's happened, the prostitute said.
Ruth sat in the scarlet-tinged light, which now cast an intensifying reddish glow throughout the small room. The pink towel on the bed where Roya sat was doubtless a deeper shade of pink because of the scarlet color of the stained glass lampshade. The only other light in the room was the muted light that managed to find its way through the window curtains from outdoors, and a dim overhead light that was trained on the door to the street. The prostitute leaned forward in the flattering light. In so doing, her breasts appeared ready to slip out of her demi-bra. Where Ruth held tightly to the armrests of the blowjob chair, Roya softly covered Ruth's hands with her own.
You want to think about what happens and come see me again?
The redhead asked.
Yes, Ruth said.
She hadn't meant to whisper, nor could she take her hands out of the prostitute's hands without falling backward in the awful chair.
Just remember, anything can happen, Roya told her. Anything you want.
Yes. Ruth whispered again. She stared at the prostitute's exposed breasts. It seemed safer than staring into her clever eyes.
Maybe if you watched me with someone, I mean you alone,
you'd get some ideas,
Roya said in a whisper of her own. Ruth shook her head, aware that the gesture conveyed far less conviction than if she'd said sharply, "No, I don't think so."
Most of the women alone who watch me are young girls, Roya announced in a louder, dismissive voice.
Ruth was so surprised at this that she looked into Roya's face without meaning to. "Why young girls?" Ruth asked. "Do you mean they want to know what having sex is like? Are they virgins?"
Roya let go of Ruth's hands. She pushed herself back on her bed and laughed. "They're hardly virgins," the redhead said. "They're young girls who are thinking about being prostitutes. They want to see what being a prostitute is like."
Ruth had never been so shocked. Not even the knowledge that Hannah had fucked her father had been this astonishing. Roya pointed to her wristwatch and stood up from her bed exactly at the same time Ruth stood up from the difficult chair. Ruth had to contort herself in order not to make contact with the prostitute. Roya opened the door to a midday sunlight of such sudden brightness that Ruth realized she'd underestimated the dimness of the lighting in the prostitute's red room. Turning away from the light, Roya dramatically blocked Ruth's exit while she bestowed on Ruth's cheeks three kisses, first on Ruth's right cheek, then on her left, and then on her right again.
"The Dutch way, three times," the prostitute said cheerfully, with an affection more suitable for old friends. Of course, Ruth had been kissed this way before, by Martin and by Martin's wife, Celia, whenever they'd said their hellos and goodbyes, but Roya's kisses had lingered a little longer. And Roya had also pressed her warm palm against Ruth's belly, causing Ruth to instinctively tighten her stomach muscles. "What a flat tummy you have," the prostitute told her. "Have you had any babies?"
"No, not yet," Ruth replied. The doorway was still blocked.
"I've had one," Roya said.
She hooked her thumbs inside the waistband of her bikini panties and lowered them in a flash.
"The hard way," the prostitute added, in reference to the highly visible scar from a cesarean section.
The scar was not nearly so surprising to Ruth, who'd already noted Roya's stretch marks, as the fact that the prostitute had shaved off her pubic hair.
"Maybe it's the easy way," Ruth managed to say. "I haven't had a baby, so I don't know."
Roya let go of the waistband of her panties, which made a snap. Ruth thought, if I'd rather be writing than what I'm doing, imagine how she feels. After all, she's a prostitute. She would probably rather be being a prostitute than flirting with me. But she also enjoys making me uncomfortable. Irritated with Roya, now Ruth just wanted to go. She tried to edge around Roya in the doorway.
"You'll be back," Roya told her, but she let Ruth slip into the street without further physical contact.
Then Roya raised her voice so that anyone passing on the Bergstraat or even a neighboring prostitute could hear her.
"You better zip up your purse in this town," the redhead said.
Ruth's purse was open, an old failing, but her wallet and passport were in place and, at a glance, whatever else should be there. A tube of lipstick and a fatter tube of colorless lip gloss, a tube of sunscreen, and a tube of moisturizer for her lips. Ruth also carried a compact that had belonged to her mother. Face powder made Ruth sneeze. The powder puff had long ago been lost. Yet at times, when Ruth looked in the small mirror, she expected to see her mother there. Ruth zipped her purse closed while Roya smiled ironically at her. When Ruth struggled to return Roya's smile, the sunlight made her squint. Roya reached out and touched Ruth's face with her hand. She was staring at Ruth's right eye with a keen interest, but Ruth misunderstood the reason. After all, Ruth was more used to people spotting the hexagonal flaw in her right eye than she was used to being punched.
"I was born with it," Ruth started to say. But Roya said, "Who hit you?"
And Ruth had thought her bruise had healed.
"About a week or two ago, it looks like."
"A bad boyfriend," Ruth confessed.
"So there is a boyfriend," Roya said.
"He's not here. I'm alone here," Ruth insisted. You're only alone until the next time you see me, the prostitute replied. Roya had only two ways of smiling, ironically and seductively. Now she was smiling seductively. All Ruth could think of saying was, "Your English is surprisingly good." But this barbed compliment, however true, had a much more profound effect on Roya than Ruth had anticipated. The prostitute lost every outward manifestation of her cockiness. She looked as if an old sorrow had returned to her with near-violent force. Ruth almost said she was sorry. But before she could speak, the redhead responded bitterly, "I knew somebody English. For a while." Then Roya Dolores went back inside her room and closed the door. Ruth waited, but the window curtains did not open. One of the younger, prettier prostitutes was scowling resentfully at Ruth from across the street, as if she was personally disappointed that Ruth should spend her money on an older, less attractive whore. There was only one other pedestrian on the tiny Bergstraat, an older man with his eyes cast down. He would not look at any of the prostitutes, but he raised his eyes sharply to Ruth as he passed by. She glared back at the man, whose eyes were fixed on the cobblestones as he walked on. Then Ruth walked on too. Her personal but not professional confidence was shaken. Whatever the possible story was, the most probable story, the best story, she had no doubt that she would think of it. She hadn't thought enough about her characters, that was all. No, the confidence she'd lost was something moral. It was at the center of herself as a woman. And whatever it was, Ruth marveled at the feeling of its absence. She would go back to see Roya again. But that was not what bothered her. She felt no desire to have any sexual experience with the prostitute, who had certainly stimulated her imagination, but who had not aroused her. And Ruth still believed that there was no necessity for her to watch the prostitute perform with a customer, neither as a writer nor as a woman. What bothered Ruth was that she needed to be with Roya again, just to see, as in a story, what would happen next. That meant that Roya was in charge. The novelist walked quickly back to her hotel, where, before her first interview, she wrote only this in her diary. The conventional wisdom is that prostitution is a kind of rape for money. In truth, in prostitution, maybe only in prostitution, the woman seems in charge. Ruth had a second interview over lunch, and a third and fourth after lunch. She should have tried to relax then, because she had an early evening reading, followed by a book signing and then a dinner. But instead, Ruth sat in her hotel room where she wrote and wrote. She developed one possible story after another, until the credibility of each felt strained. If the woman writer watching the prostitute perform was going to feel humiliated by the experience, whatever came of the experience sexually had to happen to the woman writer. Somehow, it had to be her sexual experience. Otherwise, why would she feel humiliated? The more Ruth made an effort to involve herself in the story she was writing, the more she was delaying or avoiding the story she was living. For the first time, she knew what it felt like to be a character in a novel instead of the novelist, the one in charge. For it was as a character that Ruth saw herself returning to the Bergstraat, a character in a story she wasn't writing. What she was experiencing was the excitement of a reader who needs to know what happens next. She knew she wouldn't be able to keep herself away from Roya. Irresistibly, she wanted to know what would happen. What would Roya suggest? What would Ruth allow Roya to do? When, if only for a moment, the novelist steps out of the creator's role, what roles are there for the novelist to step into? There are only creators of stories and characters in stories. There are no other roles. Now Ruth had a new one. At least it felt new to her. She'd never felt such anticipation before. She felt she had absolutely no will to take control of what happened next. In fact, she was exhilarated not to be in charge. She was happy not to be the novelist. She was not the writer of this story. Yet the story thrilled her. Ruth changes her story. Ruth stayed after her reading to sign books. Then she had dinner with the sponsors of the signing, and the following evening in Utrecht, after her reading at the university there, she also signed books. Martin and Sylvia helped Ruth with the spelling of the Dutch names. The boys wanted their books inscribed to Wouter or to Hein, Hans, Henk, Gerard or Jeroen. The girls' names were no less foreign to Ruth, to Els or to Loes, Mies, Marijke or Nell, with one L. And then there were those readers who wanted their last names included in the inscription. The Overbeeks, the Van der Merlins and the Van Meurs, the Blokhuizens and the Veldhuizens, the Dijkstras and the De Groots and the Smits. These book signings were such arduous exercises in spelling that Ruth left both readings with a headache. But Utrecht and its old university were beautiful. Before her reading, Ruth had had an early dinner with Martin and Sylvia and their grown sons. Ruth could remember when they'd been little boys. Now they were taller than she was, and one of them had grown a beard. To Ruth, still childless at 36, one of the shocks of knowing couples with children was the disquieting phenomenon of how the children grew. On the train back to Amsterdam, Ruth told Martin and Sylvia of her lack of success with boys the age of their sons, that is, when she'd been their age. The summer she'd come to Europe with Hannah, the more attractive boys had always preferred Hannah. "But now it's embarrassing. Now boys the age of your boys like me." "You're very popular with young readers," Martin said. "That's not what Ruth meant, Martin," Sylvia told him. Ruth admired Sylvia. She was smart and she was attractive. She had a good husband and a happy family. "Oh," Martin said. He was very proper. He actually blushed. "I don't mean that your boys are attracted to me in that way," Ruth quickly told him. "I mean some boys their age." "I think our boys are probably attracted to you in that way too," Sylvia told Ruth. She was laughing at how shocked her husband had been. Martin hadn't noticed the number of young men surrounding Ruth at both her book signings. There'd been many young women, too, but they were attracted to Ruth as a role model, not only as a successful writer, but also as an unmarried woman who'd had several boyfriends and yet still lived alone. Why this seemed glamorous, Ruth didn't know. If only they'd known how little she liked her so-called personal life. With the young men, there was always one boy, at least 10, but sometimes 15 years Ruth's junior, who made a clumsy effort to hit on her. "With an awkwardness that approaches heartbreaking proportions," was the way Ruth put it to Martin and Sylvia. As a mother of boys that age, Sylvia knew exactly what Ruth meant. Martin agreed. As a father, he'd paid closer attention to his sons than to the unknown young men who'd been falling all over themselves around Ruth. This time, there'd been one in particular. He'd stood in line to have his book autographed after her reading in Amsterdam and in Utrecht. She'd read the same passage on back-to-back nights, but this young man had not appeared to mind. He'd brought a well-worn copy of one of her paperbacks to the reading in Amsterdam, and in Utrecht he'd held out the hardcover of Not for Children for her signature, both English editions. "It's Wim with a W," he told her the second time, because Wim was pronounced Wim. The first time she'd signed a book for him, Ruth had written his name with a V. "Oh, it's you again," she told the boy. He was too pretty and too obviously smitten with her for her to forget him. "If I'd known you were coming, I would have read a different passage." He lowered his eyes, as if it pained him to look at her when she looked back.
I go to school in Utrecht, but my parents live in Amsterdam. I grew up there. As if this explained everything about his attendance at both her readings. Aren't I speaking in Amsterdam again tomorrow? Ruth had asked Sylvia. Yes, at the Freie Universität, Sylvia told the young man.
Yes, I know. I'll be there, the boy replied. I'll bring a third book for you to sign.
While she signed more books, the captivated boy stood off to one side of the line and looked longingly at her. In the United States, where Ruth Cole almost always refused to sign books, the young man's worshipful gaze would have frightened her. But in Europe, where Ruth usually agreed to book signings, she never felt threatened by the love-struck gazes of her young men admirers. There was a questionable logic to how nervous Ruth felt at home and how comfortable abroad. Ruth doubtless romanticized the slavish devotion of her European boy readers. They existed in an irreproachable category, these smitten boys who spoke English with foreign accents and who'd read every word she'd written. They'd also made her the older woman fantasy in their tortured young minds. They'd become her fantasy, too, which, on the train back to Amsterdam, Ruth was able to joke with Martin and Sylvia about. It was too short a train trip for Ruth to tell them everything about the new novel that was on her mind. But in laughing together about the available young men, Ruth realized that she wanted to change her story. It should not be another writer whom the woman writer meets at the Frankfurt Book Fair and then brings with her to Amsterdam. It should be one of her fans, a wannabe writer and a would-be young lover. The woman writer in the new novel should be considering that it is high time for her to be married. She should even, also like Ruth, be weighing the marriage proposal of an impressive older man whom she is deeply fond of. The unbearable beauty of the boy named Wim made him hard to put out of her mind. If Ruth hadn't only recently suffered her miserable encounter with Scott Saunders, she would even have been tempted to enjoy or embarrass herself with Wim. After all, she was alone in Europe. She was probably going home to get married. A no-regrets fling with a young man, with a much younger man? Wasn't that the kind of thing that older women who were about to marry even older men did? What Ruth did tell Martin and Sylvia was that she'd like a tour of the red light district, recounting that part of the story, or as much as she knew, how a young man talks an older woman into paying a prostitute to watch her with a customer. How something happens. How the woman is so humiliated that she changes her life. The older woman gives in to him in part because she thinks she's in control and because this young man is exactly the sort of beautiful boy who was unattainable to her when she was his age. What she doesn't know is that this boy is capable of causing her pain and anguish. At least I think that's what happens, Ruth added. It all depends on what happens with the prostitute. When do you want to go to the red light district? Martin asked. Ruth spoke as if the idea were so new to her that she hadn't yet thought of the particulars. When it's most convenient for you, I guess. When would the older woman and her young man go to the prostitute? Martin asked.
Probably at night, Ruth answered.
It's likely that they're a little drunk. I think she would have to be, to have the nerve.
We could go there now, Sylvia said. It's a roundabout way back to your hotel, but it's only a 5 or 10 minute walk from the station.
Ruth was surprised that Sylvia would even consider accompanying them. It would be after 11, close to midnight, when their train arrived in Amsterdam.
Isn't it dangerous at night? Ruth asked.
There are so many tourists, Sylvia said with distaste, that the pickpockets are the only danger.
You can get your pocket picked in the daytime, too, Martin said.
In the Valetis, or de Wallen, as the Amsterdammers called it, it was much more crowded than Ruth anticipated. There were drug addicts and drunken young men.
but the small streets were teeming with other people. There were many couples, most of them tourists, some of whom were visiting the live sex shows, and even a tour group or two. If it had been just a little earlier in the night, Ruth would have felt safe to be there alone. There was mostly a tireless seediness on display, and the people who, like her, had come there to gawk at the seediness. As for the men who were involved in the usually prolonged act of choosing a prostitute, their furtive searching was conspicuous in the midst of the unembarrassed sex tourism. Ruth decided that her older woman writer and her young man would not find the time and place conducive to approaching a prostitute, although from the confines of Roya's room it had been apparent that once inside a prostitute's chamber, the outside world quickly slipped away. Ruth's couple would either come to the district in the pre-dawn hours, when everyone except the serious drug addicts and sex addicts had gone to bed, or they would come in the early evening or daytime. What had changed about the red light district since Ruth's previous visit to Amsterdam was that so many of the prostitutes were not white. There was a street where almost all the women were Asian, probably Thais, because of the number of Thai massage parlors in the neighborhood. Indeed, they were Thais, Martin told her. He also told her that some of them had formerly been men. They'd allegedly had their sex change operations in Cambodia. On the Molensteeg, and in the area of the old church on the Oudekerksplein, the girls were all brown-skinned. They were Dominicans and Colombians, Martin told her. The ones from Suriname who'd come to Amsterdam at the end of the 60s were all gone now. And on the Bloedstraat, there were girls who looked like men, tall girls with big hands and Adam's apples. Martin told Ruth that most of them were men, Ecuadorian transvestites who had a reputation for beating up their customers. There were, of course, some white women, not all of them Dutch, in the Sint-Annenstraat and the Dolebecheinensteeg, and also in the street where Ruth wished that Martin and Sylvia had not taken her. The Trompetersteeg was not only too narrow for an alley, it was too narrow for an upstairs hall. The air was trapped in there, and a war of odors raged unceasingly. Urine and perfume so richly commingled that the result resembled bad meat. There was also a dry, scorched smell from the whore's hairdryers, and this stink of something burnt seemed incongruous because the alley, even on a rainless night, was wet. The air never moved enough to dry the puddles on the stained pavement. The walls, dirty and damp, marked the backs and chests and shoulders of the men's clothes, for the men had to press themselves against the walls in order to pass each other. The prostitutes in their windows or in their open doorways were near enough to smell and touch, and there was nowhere to look except into the face of the next one and the one after that, or into the faces of the browsing men, which were the worst faces of all, alert as they were to the prostitutes' hands flitting into the alley, making contact and making contact again. The Trompetersteeg was a buyer's market. The contact was too face-to-face for mere window shopping. Ruth realized that in De Valen one needn't pay a prostitute to see someone having sex. The motivation for that had to come from the particular young man himself, and, or from the character of the older woman writer. There would need to be something, or something missing, in their relationship. After all, in the erotic show center, one could rent video cabins. Simply the best, the advertisement read. Or at the live porno show, the promised sex was real fucking live. And in another spot, real fucking on stage. One did not have to make any great or special effort to be a voyeur here. A novel is always more complicated than it seems at the beginning. Indeed, a novel should be more complicated than it seems at the beginning. There was at least some consolation to Ruth in seeing that the SM specials in the sex shop window had not changed. The rubber vagina that resembled an omelet was once again suspended from the ceiling of the shop, although the garter from which it hung was black, not red. and no one had bought the comic dildo with the cowbell attached by a leather strap. The whips were still on display, and the enema bulbs were presented in the same or a similar selection of sizes. Even the rubber fist had endured the passage of time untouched, as defiant and unwanted as ever, Ruth thought. That is, she hoped. It was 12:30 when Martin and Sylvia returned Ruth to her hotel. Ruth had paid careful attention to the route they'd taken. In the lobby of her hotel, she kissed them both goodnight, the Dutch way, 3 times, but more quickly, more matter-of-factly, than Roya had kissed her. Then Ruth went to her room and changed her clothes. She put on an older, faded pair of blue jeans and a navy blue sweatshirt that was too big for her. It was not flattering to her figure, but it almost hid her breasts. She also put on the most comfortable shoes she'd brought with her, black suede loafers. She waited in her room for 15 minutes before leaving the hotel. It was 1:45 in the morning, but she was not even a 5-minute walk from the nearest of the prosperous streets for prostitutes. Ruth wasn't thinking of visiting Roya again at this hour. But she did want a glimpse of Roya Dolores in her window. Maybe I could watch her lure a customer inside, Ruth thought. She'd go back for a real visit the next day or the following one. Thus far, Ruth Cole's experience with prostitutes should have been a lesson to her. In the world of prostitution, Ruth's capacity to anticipate what might happen next was clearly not as developed as her skills as a novelist. One might wish that Ruth had developed at least a degree of wariness regarding her unpreparedness among women of this walk of life. For there, on the Bergstraat, in what should have been Roya's window, sat a much coarser, much younger woman than Roya. Ruth recognized the leather halter top that had hung in Roya's shallow wardrobe closet. It was black, the décolletage fastened by silver snaps, but the girl was too bosomy for the halter to be entirely closed. Beneath her deep cleavage, under the halter top, the girl's flabby stomach overhung her black half-slip, which was torn. The waistband was ripped. The white elastic contrasted with the black of the slip and the roll of sallow flesh from the fat girl's ample belly. She might have been pregnant, but the gray hollows under the young prostitute's eyes revealed a degree of inner damage that suggested her capacity for conception was minimal. "Where's Roya?" Ruth asked. The fat girl got off her stool and opened the door ajar. "With her daughter," the tired girl said. Ruth was walking away when she heard a dull thump against the window glass. It was not the familiar tapping of a fingernail or a key or a coin which Ruth had heard from the windows of several other prostitutes. The fat girl was hitting the window with the big pink dildo that Ruth had earlier seen in the hospital tray on the table by Royo's bed. Once the young prostitute had got Ruth's attention, she stuck the end of the dildo in her mouth and gave it an unfriendly tug with her teeth. Then she nodded indifferently to Ruth, and at last she shrugged, as if her remaining energy allowed her only this limited promise, that she would try to make Ruth as happy as Roya could make her. Ruth shook her head no, but she gave the young prostitute a kindly smile. In return, the pathetic creature repeatedly slapped the dildo against the palm of her hand, as if marking time to music only she could hear. That night, Ruth had a frightfully arousing dream about the beautiful Dutch boy named Wim. She awoke embarrassed and with the conviction that the bad boyfriend in her novel in progress should not be a strawberry blonde. She even doubted that he should be entirely bad. If the older woman writer was going to suffer a humiliation that would cause her to change her life, it should be she who is bad. One doesn't change one's life because someone else has been bad. Ruth was not easily persuaded by the belief that women were victims, or she was convinced that women were as often victims of themselves as they were of men.
On the evidence of the women she knew best, herself and Hannah, this was certainly true. Of course, Ruth didn't know her mother, but she suspected that Marion probably was a victim, one of her father's many victims. Furthermore, Ruth had had her revenge on Scott Saunders. Why drag him, or a look-alike strawberry blonde, into a novel? In Not for Children, the widow novelist, Jane Dash, had made the correct decision, which was not to write about her antagonist, Eleanor Holt. Ruth had already written about that. As a novelist, Mrs. Dash despised writing about real people. She found it a failure of the imagination, for any novelist worthy of the name ought to be able to invent a more interesting character than any real person. To turn Eleanor Holt into fiction, even for the purpose of derision, would be a kind of flattery. "I should practice what I preach," Ruth told herself. Given the unsatisfactory pickings in the breakfast room, and the fact that her only interview of the day was also a lunch, Ruth swallowed half a cup of lukewarm coffee and an orange juice of a similarly unappealing temperature. Then she went forth to the red light district. At 9 in the morning, it was advisable not to walk through the district with a full stomach. She crossed the Varmustrat within sight of the police station, which she didn't notice. What first caught her eye was a young, drug-addicted street prostitute who was squatting at the corner of the Enge Kerksteeg. The young addict was having difficulty maintaining her balance. She could keep herself from falling only by resting the palms of both hands on the curb as she urinated in the street. "For 50 guilders I can do anything a man can do for you," the girl said to Ruth, who ignored her. At 9 o'clock, only one window prostitute was working on the Oudekerksplein beside the old church. At first appearance, the prostitute could have been one of the Dominican or Colombian women Ruth had seen the night before. But this woman was much darker skinned. She was very black and very fat, and she stood with hearty confidence in her open doorway as if the streets of Devalin were surging with men. In fact, the streets were virtually empty, except for the street cleaners, who were picking up last night's litter and the previous day's trash. In the unoccupied cubicles for the prostitutes, many cleaning women were busily at work, their vacuum cleaners presiding over their occasional small talk. Even in the narrow Trompetersteeg, where Ruth wouldn't venture, a cleaning woman's cart containing her pail and mop and bottles of cleaning solvent protruded from a room into the alley. There was also a laundry bag of soiled towels and a bulging plastic bag of the kind that fits in a wastebasket, no doubt filled with condoms, paper towels, and tissues. Only new-fallen snow could make the district look truly clean in the penetrating morning light. Maybe on a Christmas morning, Ruth thought, when not even one prostitute would be working there. Or would there be? On the Stoofsteeg, where the Thai prostitutes had been dominant, only two women were soliciting from their open doorways. They were, like the woman by the old church, very black and very fat. They were chatting to each other in a language like no other Ruth had ever heard. And because they interrupted their conversation to give Ruth a neighborly and courteous nod, she dared to stop and ask them where they were from. "Ghana," one of the women said. "Where are you from?" the other one asked Ruth. "The United States," Ruth replied. The African women murmured appreciatively. Rubbing their fingers together, they made the universal request for money. "You want anything we can give you?" one of them asked Ruth. "You want to come inside?" the other asked. Then they laughed uproariously. They suffered from no illusion that Ruth was truly interested in having sex with them. It was simply that the well-known wealth of the United States made it impossible for them not to try to entice Ruth with their abundant wiles. "No, thank you," Ruth said to them. Still smiling politely, she walked away. There were only cleaning women in evidence where the Ecuadorian men had strutted their stuff,
And on the Molensteeg, where last night there had been more Dominicans and Colombians, there was another African-looking prostitute in a window. This one was very lean, and yet another cleaning woman in another of the cubicles. The desertion of the district gave it more of the atmosphere that Ruth had always had in mind. The look of abandonment, which was the look of unwanted sex, was better than the non-stop sex tourism of the district at night. In her all-consuming curiosity, Ruth wandered into a sex shop. As in a traditional video store, each category was afforded its own aisle. There was the spanking aisle, and the aisles for oral and anal sex. Ruth did not explore the excrement aisle, and the red light over the door to a closed video cabin prompted her to leave the shop before the customer exited the private viewing box. Ruth was willing merely to imagine his expression. For a while, she thought she was being followed. A compact, powerful-looking man in blue jeans and dirty running shoes was always behind or across the street from her, even after she'd circled the same block twice. He had a tough face with the stubble of 2 or 3 days' growth of beard and a haggard, irritable expression. He wore a loose-fitting windbreaker cut like a baseball warm-up jacket. He didn't look as if he could afford a prostitute, yet he followed her as if he thought she were one. At last he disappeared, and she stopped worrying about him. She walked in the district for 2 hours. By 11 o'clock, some of the Thais had returned to the Stoofsteeg. The Africans were gone. And around the Oudekerksplein, the one fat black woman, possibly also from Ghana, had been replaced by a dozen or more brown-skinned women, the Colombians and the Dominicans again. By mistake, Ruth turned into a dead-end alley off the Oudezijds Voorburgwal. The Slapersteeg quickly narrowed and ended at 3 or 4 prostitutes' windows, the access to which was a single door. In the open doorway, a big brown prostitute with what sounded like a Jamaican accent grabbed Ruth by her arm. A cleaning woman was still at work inside the rooms, and 2 other prostitutes were readying themselves in front of a long makeup mirror. "Who you looking for here, sugar?" the big brown woman asked. "No one," Ruth said. "I'm lost." The cleaning woman kept sullenly to her task, but the prostitutes at the makeup mirror and the big one who held fast to Ruth's arm laughed. "I'll say you is, sugar," the big prostitute said, leading Ruth out of the alley by her arm. The prostitute firmly squeezed and squeezed Ruth's arm. It was in the manner of an unasked-for massage, or like the affectionate sensual kneading of dough. "Thank you," Ruth said, as if she'd truly been lost. As if she'd truly been rescued.
"That's no problem, sugar."
This time, when Ruth again crossed the Walmustraat, she noticed the police station. 2 uniformed policemen were in conversation with the compact, powerful-looking man in the windbreaker who'd been following her. Oh, good. They've arrested him, Ruth thought. Then she guessed that the thuggish man was a plain-clothes cop. He appeared to be giving orders to the 2 cops in uniform, and he clearly recognized Ruth. As he nodded in her direction, the 2 uniformed policemen also looked at her. She was ashamed and hurried on as if she were a criminal. Dvalin was a small district. In 1 morning, she'd stood out. She'd looked suspicious. And as much as Ruth preferred Dvalin in the morning to what the district became at night, she doubted that it was the right place or time of day for her characters to approach a prostitute and pay her to allow them to watch her with a customer. They might wait all morning for the first customer. But now there was barely time to continue past the area of her hotel to the Bergstraat, where Ruth expected to find Roya in her window. It was just before midday. This time the prostitute had undergone a milder transformation. Her red hair had a less orange, coppery tone. It was darker, more auburn, almost maroon. And her demi-bra and bikini panties were an off-white, like ivory, which accentuated the whiteness of Roya's skin. By leaning over, Roya could open her door without getting off her barstool. Thus, she was able to sit in her window seat while Ruth poked her head inside. Ruth made a point of not crossing the threshold. "I haven't time to stop and see you now," Ruth said, "but I want to come back." "Fine," Roya said, shrugging. Her indifference surprised Ruth. "I looked for you last night, but someone else was in your window," Ruth went on. "She said you were spending the night with your daughter." "I spend every night with my daughter, every weekend, too," Roya replied. "The only time I'm here is when she's in school." In an effort to be friendly, Ruth asked, "How old is your daughter?" "Look," the prostitute sighed, "I'm not getting rich talking to you." "I'm sorry." Ruth stepped back from the doorway as if she'd been pushed. Before Roya leaned over and closed her door, she said, "Come see me when you have the time." Feeling like a fool, Ruth chastised herself for having had such high expectations of a prostitute. Of course, money was the main thing on Roya's mind, if not the sole thing. Here Ruth was trying to treat the woman as a friend, when all that had really happened was that Ruth had paid her for their first conversation.